Do you ever struggle with the question, if God is good, why is there suffering? We unpack this timeless question in a free chapter download from Why You Can Believe. It's called Why Does God Allow Suffering? And it's honest, hopeful, and deeply personal. From free will to a broken world, to the way suffering can lead us to God, this chapter will equip you with real biblical insight. Get your free download today at premierinsight.org/resources. Again, that's premierinsight.org/resources.
Hello and welcome along to Unbelievable, the programme that brings Christians and non-Christians together every week. I'm Justin Brierley, bringing you the conversations that matter from a Christian and non-Christian perspective. And if you're unfamiliar with the show, you'd like to download the podcast, see some of the other features, interviews, videos and resources, do go to premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. You can find today's programme there. You can also find links to the Unbelievable conference from this year on DVD and MP3 CD. That's available to pre-order, I believe. The digital download edition, though, is already available if you prefer to do it that way. Again, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable for all the details. Excitingly, of course, the Unbelievable book is now in circulation. Lots of people tweeting me and Facebooking me their book arriving in the post. It's great to see that. Tuesday, the 11th of July, we give a bit more detail about this later on in the show. We're doing a special book launch in Woking in Surrey. Do ring fence that if you can get along. And some exciting dates coming up in the summer. I'll be speaking at Creation Fest down in Cornwall in August as well. So lots to look forward to. Straight after Unbelievable, this afternoon, you can hear the profile. Seth and Nerva, musicians, join Sam Hales for today's edition of the programme. Right now, though, time to get into this week's conversation.
You're unbelievable.
Well, today on the programme, I'm being interrogated on Unbelievable the Book by no less than a former police officer. Mike Rand joins me on the programme today. And the tables are turned to some extent because I'm being interviewed about my case for the Christian faith, as spelled out in my newly released book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. So asking the questions this week, rather than me, it's former police officer Mike Rand. Now, Mike is an agnostic, theistic-leaning agnostic, I think you would say, a regular listener of the show. He actually came on just over a year ago to have a brilliant discussion with David Robertson, who's a regular show contributor. And I so enjoyed meeting Mike and his style and just the way he brought things across. And I know many people who enjoyed that programme. So I sent my book out before it was released. I sent the sort of manuscript to Mike to see what he thought of it as a non-believer. And he was very lovely and gracious about it. And in fact, even contributed an endorsement in the end to the book as a regular show listener. So I thought, wouldn't it be fun now that I'm here trying to get word out about the book to actually have Mike come on and interview me about the book? And so Mike is here to do that. Mike, thank you for coming in.
Well, thank you, Justin. Thanks for the invite. It's a great pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you back.
Thank you.
This is obviously slightly strange and experimental and different to the normal way we do the show, of course. I'm usually the one directing things and asking the questions, but you're going to be sort of putting on your old hat of police interrogation unit. And
hopefully not. When you said interrogation, it won't be much of an interrogation, I can tell you. But certainly, I've read your book. It's an excellent book, and I'm not saying that because you've invited me.
Because
up.
Because I've slipped you a tenner earlier.
Yeah, you slipped me a tenner, and I'm on a commission basis. No, I'm reassured. I can reassure people. I'm certainly not on that. But it's an excellent book. I've really enjoyed it. But of course, like with anything that's written around these particular issues, it raises more questions as you're reading it.
Yeah, and so, of course. Yeah.
You've very kindly come up, and perhaps you can answer some of those for me today. It'd be lovely.
Well, I will do my best. I can only promise to do that. Mike, with your background, though, as a former copper, I mean, I guess, as we said last time that you came on the show, you're kind of interested in evidence and that sort of thing. And you've been on a bit of a quest yourself for looking into Christianity. You want to give us the brief story of what happened?
Yeah, I mean, very, very briefly. I don't come from a Christian family at all. And I served 30 years within the police service in Hertfordshire and in Dorset, and 10 years as a civilian member of staff. And by about 1998, it became apparent to me that I was developing something of a pretty serious drink problem. Mm. So much so that a good friend of mine took me to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. And while the first day I walked into this Alcoholics Anonymous meeting, I had what I can only describe as a spiritual experience. It's the only way I can put it. I know that people could say, well, there's an explanation because it was a sense of relief or there was a group ethic around the meeting. But there was more to it than that, because I've been sober now for 19 years since. I've never picked up a drink since. Right. And there's something within me that's desperately trying to seek and find out what that experience was all about.
And at some point you stumbled across Unbelievable and have been listening for several years now.
Yeah, I've been listening for quite a number of years now. And that's in itself has taken me off in all sorts of different directions, reading all sorts of different authors, trying to piece together what I've experienced with what the Christian church tells me. And that's where I found the difficulty, is that what I experience, I don't actually find answers within the Christian church.
Well, you kind of spelled this out when you came on the show just over a year ago. And if people want to be reminded of that, I will post a link from today's programme as well, where they can hear your conversation with David Robertson, which had a really interesting response, actually. So many people actually said that was such a great discussion, because you were very lively, obviously so is David, and I think it was very much the kind of conversations we do have at a, you know, non-academic level, let's say, where people are simply asking, I don't get this, or what about that, or what about this?
Well, certainly, I mean, having listened to your show for a number of years, sometimes you do get academic and philosophy people who talk in great depth, and while I admire them, and I wish I could do that myself, I do come from just an honest Joe, ordinary Joe's point of view of saying, well, that's okay, but what about this, or how does this fit in, or whatever. And so this really isn't an interrogation. It really is just it's just some questions that I think perhaps other people might ask. I don't know.
Well, look, I know you're not going to be the bad cop. You're going to be the good cop on today's programme. But I'm looking forward to hearing what you made of the book, what the questions are that have come out from it. And I'll do, as I say, my best to answer it. In fact, we'll probably do this in two parts, and we'll have another chance to look at, maybe we'll look at the first part of the book today and more chapters on another time. But Mike, thank you for coming in.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you.
To interview me on the programme today.
Okay.
If you are interested by anything you hear on the programme today, and interested in getting hold of the book, of course, that's available now. Unbelievablebook.co.uk has all the links and information you need. Wherever you're listening from in the world, we can send you the book. You can even download the first chapter for free, actually, at the website. That's unbelievablebook.co.uk. It's very much my story of doing this show for over 10 years now, bringing Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, and why, after 10 years of hearing some of the objections from some of the leading atheists in the world, I'm still a Christian. It's my case for faith. And we don't do this often on the show, but we've got a special giveaway today on the programme. Chance of winning one of five signed copies of Unbelievable, the book. If you want to enter the draw, it's very simple. You just go online to the programme webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on the competition link there. Leave us your details. Tell us why you listen to Unbelievable as well, and you will be entered into the prize draw. Do that by Monday, the 17th of July, to be entered into that competition. And we'll announce the winners on the following show. But for the moment, we're talking about Unbelievable, the book, on Unbelievable Today. I'm being interrogated. It's not really interrogation. It's a nice conversation with former police officer Mike Rand, who's an agnostic listener of Unbelievable. And we're going to be hearing what he made of the book and talking through some of the arguments for God I make in the course of the early chapters of the book. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So if you want to get in touch with anything you hear about on the show today, do email in as well, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. Look forward to receiving your thoughts about today's programme. You can also, of course, find the social media pages online as well, at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All that and much more available from the website as well, where you can find today's programme, comment about it, find links as well to where Mike previously appeared on the programme, and much more besides. Again, that's premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. So I guess we should start this conversation, Mike. And you've already said very kindly that you found it a helpful and sort of interesting book to read. What were your kind of questions, though, that emerged, especially, I guess, in the opening chapters?
Well, I suppose, I mean, the initial thought was, why write the book in the first place? I mean, what was your reasons behind writing it?
I think having done the show for over 10 years, I felt that was a good point at which to start making reflections on it, because it's the sort of thing where you're constantly learning.
Right.
My views have shifted and changed and been shaped along the way. But I felt like, okay, after 10 plus years of doing the show, I feel that I've got enough experience under my belt to finally say something about where I, how I feel the conversations, if you like, have shaped me and my approach to faith and the way that I look at things now. And I was also simply aware that, you know, that as the audience for Unbelievable has grown as a podcast around the world, there might be an audience for this kind of a book. And
yeah.
And obviously my hope is also that it will reach beyond the core Unbelievable audience. And if it doesn't sound too pompous, I also felt like having sat on this side of the studio for so long and listened to people talking about the case for and against faith, I thought, I feel like I'm in a position now to kind of summarise and perhaps helpfully put across some of those arguments in an accessible way.
Yeah, because the book itself isn't just a series of anecdotes about people you've met.
Mm.
It's not like the greatest hits of Unbelievable.
That's right, yeah.
It's also some quite strong views about why you're still a Christian.
Exactly, yeah. And I think that was always going to be the trickiest part in a way,
yeah.
Because obviously with my Unbelievable moderator hat on, I try and remain reasonably neutral and try and make sure both sides are given a fair hearing. Obviously, in this case, I'm taking off that neutral moderator's
yes.
cap and saying, okay, time for me to lay my cards on the table.
Yeah.
And inevitably, that'll mean people disagree with me or even get upset with me, as some people have on Twitter, because they feel, oh, I assumed you were a rational person, Justin, but here you are making those same arguments I've heard defeated time and again on Unbelievable. You know,
do you think that by writing the book that this may change people's perception of you?
You are
famously good at being very balanced and a good moderator. But now, in some respect, now you've laid your cards on the table, as it were, there's a danger that you could view that you've now got two Christians against one atheist.
Yeah, and that is a danger that you always run by doing this. And it's one of the big things I had to think about before I did a book. I thought, especially a book where I'm, yeah, taking a particular position, is that going to now skew people's thinking, oh, Justin's, you know, he's no longer the neutral moderator
yeah.
I thought he was. I hope not, because obviously I've never hidden the fact I'm a Christian
no.
on this programme. And if you listen for long enough, you will have heard me, you know, obviously talk about my own Christian faith at some point or another.
Yeah.
It's just I don't tend to lay it out there, you know, obviously all the time, because I want to make sure that it's the other people in the programme who are the focus of the discussion. Having said that, I hope that you won't find that, even though this book is available and anywhere, that would change in any way the way I actually conduct
no.
the debates, and
no.
that you can come back and still hear me trying to make sure both sides are treated fairly.
One of the things that struck me was, you know, it's a decent length book. How long did it take you to write it, and how on earth did you fit it in with everything else you do? You're the editor of the Premier magazine. You've got a huge busy home life.
Together
with this show as well.
And you're absolutely right. You don't take on writing a book lightly. I was given the brief of it needing to be about 60,000 words long.
Right.
So I sort of knew that was going to take me sort of X amount of time to more or less write. Now, I started, if you like, with a good start, because I'd already obviously thought about a lot of these ideas. The book had been kind of bubbling away in my mind for a while. I'd even written some articles of certain length for the magazine in the past, which I knew I could take the ideas and sort of expand on them for some of the chapters. And so to some extent, I sort of felt that's doable at some level. But I did have to take some time out of the office to really concentrate on it. Blessed to have a wonderfully competent deputy editor for the magazine who took the reins of the magazine while I was out of the office and sort of had my head down. And I just basically sat in a coffee shop.
Yeah, I read that. It's a coffee shop in Surrey somewhere.
Several weeks on end.
Must have cost you a fortune.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they made a mint out of me. But yeah, just banging away in the corner, sort of just trying to, pull it together. I mean, probably, I had a sort of 4-week stretch where I kind of got out of the office and just worked,
continuously
every day.
On it, as it were. Yeah.
Then I came back to work for a bit, and then I had another couple of weeks where I was working again, and then,
yeah.
you know, bits and pieces here and there, obviously. So I guess started in October last year, 2016, and the final manuscript was sent in sort of the end of January 2017.
Oh, that's pretty quick, then. That's and pretty good.
So sort of four months period in which it was essentially the bulk of it was written.
Yeah. Well, the opening chapters of your book talk about your background and how you grew up in a Christian family. For the sake of the listeners who haven't read the book yet, can you just expand a bit on that? How you came to faith, as it were?
I do briefly spell out my early days in the faith, and I grew up in a Christian family. So grew up going to church, but it was really an experience on a youth retreat at about the age of 15, where I really felt God impact my life in a kind of remarkable way. I guess my faith went from being something inherited from my parents to being something very much owned by myself.
Can you go a bit deeper with that? I picked that up. It's one of the things I was interested in, because I think the experience of God is very powerful. How did that manifest itself for yourself?
Well, it manifested itself in quite sort of an emotional response. Tears, laughing, a kind of what you might call an experience of the Holy Spirit, to use the lingo. Yeah. And different people have very different ways in which they may say they've experienced God. That was my one. It was a very much a wham bam in that moment. Something happened,
right.
and I couldn't deny it. And it sort of stayed with me really for the rest of my life. My wife has a very different story, where she never had any kind of, big wham bam conversion moment like that. God was always just there as a sort of reality, sort of underpinning her life, and her faith matured and grew as she went on. Mine sort of did have this kind of kickstart moment, which I felt was quite pivotal, but certainly.
And do you still feel that now? Is that still part of your?
It's certainly part of my story. I mean, my faith obviously has changed and developed and grown in all manner of ways since those early days. But certainly, I look back as that being, you could say my road to Damascus moment or whatever.
Quite difficult for a 15-year-old as well, because at 15 you've got all sorts of different emotions going on.
Completely.
And I think about the peer group that I was with in Watford when I was 15, and they would have laughed me out the bloody room if I'd have turned around and said I found God. So unless, I suppose, if your background, your peer group was all similar church people, it would be different.
This particular, obviously I had a peer group at school which was not Christian.
No, and that must have been quite difficult for you there.
To some extent. I think, I grew up, though, with some great examples, especially in my youth pastor and others, who helped me to nurture and develop my faith, obviously, from that point onwards. But I immediately, encountered skepticism or just apathy, really, often from friends who suddenly I came back from this youth weekend and I was sort of, super zealous Justin.
Yeah.
And they were just a bit like, oh, what happened to you then?
Yeah.
And obviously it's very difficult to explain on the basis of a sort of spiritual experience you've had to someone else who just hasn't had that kind of an experience, why things are suddenly different. But I can only describe it like the world came on in a different color almost for me at that point. Probably, today, a Derren Brown or someone could explain it as you had some, interesting brain experience that sort of,
some euphoria that came from the group meeting.
Something happened. Maybe you probably could give it some kind of a naturalistic explanation, on reflection. But for me, rather like the experience you described at the beginning of the program, I've never felt that that's all it was. I've always felt it goes deeper at some level.
You would imagine if it was just a naturalistic explanation, you would imagine that that would have faded away by now, wouldn't you?
You would think so, I think. And and to some extent, I've never replicated that. That was quite a unique experience that I had.
Okay.
I've still felt certainly moments when I felt God's presence and, an experience, if you like, that has been with me in some way. Because for me, as much as obviously a lot of my professional life has been involved with the intellectual pursuit of Christianity and looking at these sorts of questions we do on Unbelievable, I would never want to divorce that from the experience of the presence of God and prayer and all those things that actually make for a holistic Christian faith. And that's the huge danger, of course, with apologetics, is we can tend to focus on one to the detriment of the other.
The intellectual side as opposed to the actual experiential side of it. Yeah.
And so I always do go back to the fact that my faith was birthed in something experiential. I can't deny that. Mm. But it's very difficult to justify that to someone else. And so we are inevitably left wanting to look for objective reasons for our faith as well, that hopefully, from my perspective, I can present to someone who hasn't had that same experience, but for whom you might want to invite into dipping their toes into opening themselves up to something.
You mentioned your wife just there. You then went on to a university education, and you met your wife at university.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. She came from a very different Christian background.
Yeah,
herself.
She did. Yeah, I talk about this a little bit again in the opening chapter, and that was because she came from a church tradition that wasn't sort of in the evangelical charismatic side of things that my church was, and in many ways, you know, we had to. It was a bit of a difficult process actually finding how to get along. Sort of, we knew that we worked together psychologically, you know, romantically and everything else, but actually, we came from quite different denominational backgrounds in right. that sense. So there was a bit of rubbing to find out, okay, how are we going to make this work? And in a way, those early conversations and debates and sort of the way we sort of managed to find the way that we were going to live together in that sense was actually a good grounding for what I do on the programme.
Yeah, absolutely.
Funnily enough, from week to week, because I had to sort of get a bigger picture, in a way, of Christianity. I think even though I'd had this amazing experience and everything, I still had a fairly small view of the what Christianity can be. And I came to appreciate, especially not just through Lucy at university, but through other friends at Oxford and indeed other experiences that I went on to have, that the Christian church is very broad, and God is, if you like, meeting people in all kinds of ways, in all kinds of different cultures and places, in all kinds of manners, which go far beyond my very limited experience.
Do you think that's a good thing, though? I mean, the fact that the Christian church is very broad, does that cause it, to me, as an outsider looking in, that seems to cause it problems, because...
It does.
It's as an outsider, which one is the true path to, you know, to
well,
Christianity?
It's a blessing and a curse, in the sense that I think the fact that we have so much diversity in the Christian church means that inevitably it looks like we're falling out with each other
all
the time.
From an outsider,
things.
Certainly does. Yeah,
of course. At the same time, though, I think one of the most important things that God's given us to do as the Christian church is learn how to have unity in diversity. I think that, for me, one of the lessons I take from the fact that we are so different is that maybe God's got a reason, actually, behind that, for why there is such a lot of difference, and that is to recognise the things that do ultimately matter, that do bind us together as Christians. I'm not saying anything goes by that. You know, I there are some things I think are pretty fundamental to being a Christian, but I still think we're coming to a point, especially I think as in the West, as Christianity's been in decline, as you know, that we don't have the luxury of falling out with each other as much as we used to.
No.
If we're going to make a difference and have our voice heard, we have to kind of actually come together in a more significant way, and that may mean trying to get past some of the things that have historically divided us.
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you read stuff into the press and whatever, and there's obviously one set of churches arguing with another set of churches.
But a lot of that stuff, in my experience,
you're evolving a lot, aren't you?
So yeah, inevitably. But if I'm honest, Mike, a lot of that stuff happens at a national level, at the press level.
Right.
You come down to the local church level, people are just getting on with it a lot of the time. And I often find there's a bit of a disjuncture between the kind of the media kind of picture of the church falling apart at the seams and, you know, breaking up over women bishops and gay bishops and all the rest of it.
Yeah.
And actually, on the ground level, I'm getting on with my Methodist, Catholic, Baptist, you know, whatever friends to make a difference when we go out on the streets on a Saturday night with doing the street pastors or whatever it might be. And so, yeah, I think it can give a bit of a biased picture sometimes.
Yeah. Okay. So you leave university and you do a gap year, and then you start work at Premier Christian Radio. How did that come about? How did you get a job here then?
Well, I asked for one, basically.
I mean, it must have been very short.
I'd been away on this gap year in Namibia. While there, the director of our charity actually got had an interview on Premier Christian Radio and said, "Oh, I know you're looking for a job in the media when you get back home, Justin. Have you thought of applying?" And I did, and I got sort of very much a learning the ropes kind of internship, which turned into a job pretty quickly.
Excellent.
At Premier.
Yeah.
Spent several years learning the ropes of live radio on the Inspirational Breakfast show. Eventually got up the nerve to ask the CEO of the station, could I have my own slot in the schedule? And Unbelievable was born at that point.
Was it actually your idea, the format of
it
having
was.
A Christian? And
yeah. I knew we were really good at doing the Christians, talking to Christians about Christian things, and there's definitely a place for that. But I really wanted something where we would actually reach out of the bubble a bit and kind of model, hopefully, for Christians listening, because I was only thinking really of the Christians who were listening at that point. What a good discussion, a good sort of, you know, kind of conversation could look like. It was only later, of course, that through the podcast that lots of non-Christians started listening as well. And that changed the dynamic again, because suddenly you've got both sides listening on the other side. And, and again, that meant that the show probably evolved and changed a bit more, realising that it had this dual audience.
Because initially the show was a phone-in, wasn't it?
That's right, yeah.
I never heard it as a phone-in. Yeah. I'd like to hear a phone-in.
Well,
I think
there you
it'd
go.
Be great.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, if you go far enough back in the podcast archive, you might hear one or two episodes which I kind of replayed that it did involve some of those phone-in early shows where there was phone-ins. The only problem with the phone-in was it would go in all kinds of random directions depending on who phoned it.
It's an inherent danger, isn't it?
Which was fun.
Somebody could say something really
but,
bad.
Well, you know, that's just the nature of doing phone-ins. But what it did mean is it tended to, you'd get a guest in to talk about something and you'd end up going in all kinds of interesting directions.
Okay.
What by sort of moving to a kind of more pre-recorded format, it meant that we could actually focus a little bit more directly on the subject.
Would you go back to
debating.
A phone-in again in the future?
Oh, I'm open to it. You know, maybe the odd live edition of the show where we take some calls, you
that'd
know, into the programme. Well, yeah,
that
would be fun.
One of the things that struck me was there must have been a bit of a reticence to do the programme initially, because there's a grave danger that you're introducing atheist thought into Christian radio.
Huge question mark. And that was very much a discussion point in the early, you know, months of the programme was, you know, most Christians listening to Premier Christian Radio did not expect to turn their radio set on and hear a cherished doctrine being run over by an atheist. Yeah. And so, yes, certainly there were people who said, can't you keep the atheists on the BBC where they belong, you know, rather than on our Christian radio station. And I totally understand that.
Yeah.
And in a sense, Unbelievable has always in that sense been not quite fitted the mould of what you might expect, certainly, say, on the US American Christian radio station.
Yes.
It's a little bit less safe because you're hearing that other point of view. But for those for whom they wanted that, they wanted to be able to have that kind of grown-up discussion about faith and belief and doubt, they valued it immensely. And so I think it just came to the point where people who knew it wasn't their cup of tea would skip that section on a Saturday afternoon, those who enjoy it.
I mean, I've got an example of somebody I used to work with. I obviously won't name names, but somebody I worked with quite closely was a very, very devout Christian. And I used to love to try and talk to him in a lunch hour for about spiritual matters, but he would never really open up to me, because the moment I started throwing doubts in, I could see he was very uncomfortable.
And I hope, in a way, that's the whole point of the show. And to be honest, you know, when some of those early shows where things were objections to God were presented really cogently and persuasively, I was, you know...
Well, I was going to ask you about that.
You know, it affected me, and I thought, crumbs, that is a really kind of powerful way of putting it.
Yeah.
But I think it's actually, if you don't sort of deal with those kinds of issues at some point, it's impossible to kind of hide from them forever. We live in an internet age where skepticism is rampant, and I think for our young people especially, it's more important than ever that they are given the tools to think about these things. And Unbelievable, I hope, even though it's not always comfortable listening, gives Christians the tools to do that and realize actually there are answers out there. There are very good questions, but there are answers, and we need to be willing to listen. We're going to have to go to a break, Mike.
Okay.
This is an odd experience because you're the interviewer today, but I'm still having to kind of try and keep us to time. But thank you for coming on to ask the questions. We're going to look at some of the further chapters in the book. We're talking about Unbelievable, the book today. It's a book that's now available to order from the website unbelievablebook.co.uk. You can also download the first chapter free there. It's my story about the show and my case for faith after 10 years of talking with atheists. Special giveaway today. You can win one of 5 signed copies of the book. To enter the draw, go to the show webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on the competition link. Leave us your details. Tell us why you listen to the show. By Monday, the 17th of July, you'll be in with a chance of winning one of those 5 signed copies. We'll be back again in a couple of moments' time with a part 2 of this week's Unbelievable. I'm being interrogated today by former police officer Mike Rand about my new book.
Premier and SPCK invite you to London Bible Week. Your opportunity to hear renowned speakers Tom Wright, Krish Kandaya, Elaine Storkey, Rowan Williams, Celia Appiagi Collins, and Calvin Samuel, with worship led by Lou Fellingham, Meet Jesus in God's Word and hear what God is really saying to us. London Bible Week, from the 17th to the 22nd of July at Emmanuel Centre, Westminster. Revealing truth, meeting Jesus in God's Word.
For tickets and information, visit londonbibleweek.com.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the programme. Unbelievable is the show that brings Christians and non-Christians together for dialogue and debate, conversations that matter every week. Doing things a bit differently today, though, because today on the programme, me, Justin Brierley, the host, is becoming the interviewee. And one of my former interviewees, Mike Rand, who's a theistic-leaning agnostic, I think, would be one way of putting it, a former police officer by profession, he's actually come in to ask the questions because we're talking about my new book, Unbelievable, Why, After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian. Very much the story of the show, why I've been bringing people together for these kinds of conversations, and in the process, how I make the case for God and Christianity. And Mike's been asking some of the questions about the genesis of the show and my own personal faith journey in the process in the beginning of today's programme. We're going to continue by talking about some of the early chapters of the book where I sort of make my case, really lay my cards on the table for the existence of God, why I think that makes more sense of the world, of our lives, than does an atheistic explanation of the universe and life. Don't forget that if you're listening and you'd like to leave some feedback, you can do that by emailing in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can also find us online at UnbelievableJB for the Twitter, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for the Facebook page. All of those links, more, and of course to the podcast, lots of features, videos, this year's Unbelievable Conference on DVD, and of course the book itself available from the webpage of the programme, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. And again, a special giveaway on the show today, as well as obviously being able to go ahead straight away and buy the book at unbelievablebook.co.uk, where you can download the first chapter as well. We've also got 5 signed copies to give away. To enter the draw, go to the show webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on the competition link, leave us your details. Tell us why you listen to Unbelievable as well. Do that by Monday, 17th of July. You'll be entered into that prize draw to win 1 of 5 signed copies of the book. I must say, Mike, doing this, it's a very odd thing. I feel terribly
nervous.
Nervous, pretentious for signing copies of books, which I've never done before in my life. Yeah. But it seems to be the thing people like.
Yeah,
I'm happy to oblige. But also,
it's the signing of checks you need to do. Yeah.
But also the fact that the spotlight is turned on me,
yes,
inevitably.
Strange feeling.
And it is a strange feeling because I've never sought, to be honest, you know, to be the spotlight. It's always been on the other guests in the show, but now it's me in the hot seat answering the questions.
Well,
but,
you're doing very well.
Thank
Justin.
You very much. Thank you.
You could make a living out of it. You could do. So just before, there's only one question I was just going to ask you just before the break, and that was, you just mentioned effects on your own personal faith. Has there ever been a discussion on the show that's thrown serious doubts into you? I mean,
there's probably been several, but one that stands out was, I remember the very first time I had Bart Ehrman on, and those who are long-time show listeners will perhaps know that Bart is an agnostic Bible scholar. He was a Christian at one time, but he lost his faith. And he tells that story several times, actually, in his popular-level books. So what you get with Bart is a sort of scepticism about the reliability of the New Testament documents. And perhaps his best-selling book to date was Misquoting Jesus. And this was the first time I was going to have him on. This was going back 5 or 6 years now, probably. And I got the book sort of just before Christmas, I remember, in order to prepare for the show that we were going to record in the new year. And it really contained a lot of stuff that I found, wow, I hadn't encountered a lot of this stuff. Basically, it was making the case that we can't really trust the New Testament documents about Jesus because of the transmission of the texts over the years.
Yeah.
Meant that lots of copying errors and changes and so on had
got
crept
oral,
in.
Oral to
well,
start with.
You've obviously got the period of time when you're looking at obviously there being an oral tradition, but then really what Bart was dealing with was from the point where it's written down.
Okay.
From that point on, you're talking about obviously lots of different papyri scrolls being written and copied and copied again and so on. And you don't have the originals, you know.
No.
Those have disintegrated a long time ago. And so that raised all kinds of questions for, well, how can we trust this? And he would have things in the book about, you know, so many hundreds, thousands of variations between the various manuscripts and so on.
Mm.
And it gave me sort of pause for thought, you know, one or two kind of nights where I was mulling it over and, you know, finding it difficult to get to sleep, frankly. So anyway, the day came for having the discussion, and the person I was having on with him was Peter J. Williams, who's a new and Old Testament scholar from Cambridge at Tyndale House. And what that kind of taught me, I suppose, was that old adage that, you know, you hear one side and you become sort of convinced, and then you hear the other side and you realise there's another side to the story.
Yeah.
And I think he very helpfully presented the ways in which actually the number and variation of the manuscripts we have in our hands, and going back, you know, quite a long time, is actually the strength as well of what we call biblical textual criticism, this almost detective-like process that we can then engage in to actually uncover what the original manuscripts actually said to an extraordinary degree of accuracy, in fact.
Right.
And in a way, that was a lesson for me that, you know, people will spin things in different directions. And for me, I felt that actually Peter really helpfully unpacked that we do have a way of getting back to the original text. And there are, of course, one or two areas which are still in dispute.
Yes.
But if you actually read Bart's book, it was only really a handful, actually, of particular sort of sections where he felt there was some question mark over what
right.
the original would have said, or whether we've translated it correctly. Mm. And he had an opinion anyway on what that would be. So in a sense, it was one of those ones where it certainly gave me a lot of questions and pause for thought. But then in the process of hearing it discussed and debated, it kind of helped me to realise.
There was a balance. Okay, balance for you came in. So as far as inerrancy goes, does that matter too much to you?
Well, it's one of those issues where I talk about it briefly in the book, that I'm more interested, for the sake of sort of what we can know, about the reliability of Scripture. And it's not a hill I'm prepared to die on, the inerrancy debate, because it will mean different things for different people.
Mm.
I'm happy to affirm that for all aspects of faith and doctrine and teaching, the Bible is sufficient and is trustworthy and true. Then you've got all these kind of, but whether you're asking me, you know, is it scientifically accurate when it says, Jesus says, you know, for the mustard seed is the smallest of all the seeds. Well, okay, turns out that maybe the mustard seed isn't, but in Jesus' context, that would have been.
I think what I'm trying to say is that if the message of Jesus is true, the exact wording of whether he actually said those precise words probably doesn't become that important, does it?
Well, I think.
Or is it?
I think on this one, obviously, there's things you can either take on faith, or we've only got, you know, what we have in front of us in terms of the documents and so on.
Yeah.
And we have what obviously was recorded by the people at the time who were writing down what was being told them about the things that Jesus said and did. And I'm sure some of those are things that he said and did so many times that they were kind of encapsulated in sayings and stories and things that, you know, like the preacher who always has his 3-point sermon, and the congregation get to know that story so well because he's told it X many times. As to exactly whether, you know, I think it's a really interesting area whether we've got some sort of, I don't think we have a sort of tape recording version of, you know, the Sermon on the Mount.
I don't think
we
can have.
Yeah, exactly.
It's not possible because, I mean, having dealt with witnesses over the years, you know, as the story goes on, it's bound to become embellished, whether deliberately or, you know, not deliberately, whether it's just done because that's how human beings are. You know, I can tell you a story, a reminiscence that I have, and by the time I've finished the story, I've embellished it somewhat. That's the way it is. Now, the gist might well be true, but I find it very difficult to believe that inerrancy can be true.
Well, it does depend on what you call inerrancy, and it's not a term I tend to use because I think it can be quite unhelpful in a way. I would say we have a reliable account of the stories and doings and sayings of Jesus. Obviously, I sort of part of it is a faith belief that actually I think God has faithfully preserved an accurate account of the sayings and doings of Jesus. But I also think, just sort of historically, you can say this is a well-attested document that goes, you know, compared to other similar documents of its time, it's, you know, very close to the original sources. Now, as to sort of the nature of the way it was put together and how people recorded and was eventually wrote down the words of Jesus, I think you have to judge that in its own time and place.
Yes.
Because I think very often, and we did an episode recently on this with Mike Lacona and Richard Burridge, that we tend to judge the Bible by modern biographical standards, and we maybe need to see it in its own context and judge it by those standards.
Absolutely, yeah.
Saying all that, I still feel that it does, for me, represent a reliable and trustworthy kind of account of who Jesus was and what he did and said.
I've gone off the tangent.
That's all right. Yeah, that's fine.
That's what happens.
I deal with that a little later in the book,
yes,
to some extent, talking about, you know, the whole question of did Jesus exist and those who say he didn't and all of that. Kind
of thing. No, that's a very interesting chapter, actually. And personally, I wouldn't have any problem thinking that Jesus existed. Whether the
of course the question is do we kind of have a true account of his life and sayings.
And while I would have no problem with the gist of the account. The fine detail sometimes.
Sure.
I
guess that's the question. I mean, for me, in the end, a lot of it comes down to, well, is there evidence that he rose from the dead? Because if we can establish that as a likely sort of explanation of the events surrounding his, I mean, we'll maybe come to this in a second show.
Chapter 7 or something.
but there's a sense in which we're kind of, you know, a lot of this kind of debate about the exact wordings of things kind of goes by the by. If he rose from the dead, then we've got to factor that into our worldview.
Yeah.
And then we can have an argument, a discussion about the exact nature of what's written down elsewhere in the text. But, where are we going next?
Well, I was
Mike?
Looking at chapter 2.
You're the
two.
Boss today.
We've only just got to chapter 1. Sorry, listeners. We've only just got to chapter 1. Chapter 2, you talk about God making sense of human existence.
Mm.
This is a creation chapter, really. You open it with a description of beauty of a clear night sky, appreciation of music, flowers, nature and stuff. I mean, even Richard Dawkins would say that he would have no problem with appreciating the greatness of nature, but obviously wouldn't attribute that to anything that's godlike.
Yeah. I guess what I'm trying to do in this chapter is to say we're all, you know, whether we're a Christian or an atheist, we're all coming at the world with a kind of an explanation for the things that we see. And what I'm trying to do in really chapter 2, 3, and 4 is say that there are three ways in which I find God is a better explanation than atheism. And by atheism, I'm often assuming, though many of my atheist friends won't like it, but I'm kind of saying I'm assuming some kind of a naturalism, that all that exists is, you know, the physical stuff of the universe and
matter,
and that everything else is somehow can be explained ultimately by those kinds of non-rational, non-directed kind of processes. And for me, you know, what I'm aiming to do in this chapter, saying that God makes sense of human existence, is to say there are all kinds of things that we appear to be able to see from science and our knowledge of the universe that point for me in the direction of God as an explanation and away from it all just being, you know, a fluke, essentially. These are highly debated, obviously.
Yeah, but, I mean, there's been a lot of programs on this, on the space of the creation programs. Mm. But to me, I mean, I've got two views. It's more than possible, in my mind, that we've got a naturalistic explanation for the creation, in as much as that we are all part of stardust. We've all come together. We are matter. It's just a pure fluke. And I've seen your Cosmic Dice video. But it's just, we're here because we're here. It's just happened. And as bleak and as dark and as it may be from a Christian viewpoint, there is nothing else. This is where we are. We've evolved over billions of years. We've become the creatures we now become. And that is how we're meant to be. On the other hand, part of me looks at some of the odds against that and the fine-tuning stuff. And I have to say that there is quite a strong argument to say that this is just almost too good to be true. It's too unbelievable. Great phrase.
I mean, obviously, I have a lot of sympathy, basically, for the argument from fine-tuning. I think sort of there are forms of the cosmological argument which are simply, why is there anything at all, really? And again, you can look at the fact that we seem to have said this universe wasn't always here. You know, it came from this kind of almost starting point. Now, obviously, people debate whether that really was a starting point or whether there was something before that in the form of a quantum vacuum that generated this. But even if you go back that far, for me, that it still raises the whole question, why is there anything at all? I think often we're so used to being part of this physical existence, we often never stop to ask ourselves the most fundamental question, which is why is there something rather than nothing? I think that's a really interesting question to ask. It's not just a sort of, you know, university philosopher, you know, question to ask. It's actually something that on the when you stop and think about it, is an extraordinary fact of reality that there is something. And then you've got, you know, and then the way the universe appeared to spring into existence in all kinds of crazy ways, the fine tuning that it took for there to be the right kinds of chemicals and forces in life to create
life.
To even have the basis for life being able to begin. And you add all those things together. And then even for me, one of the most interesting things on top of all of those, which have frequently been debated on the show, is that we live in a universe which is so incredibly open to being discovered by physics and science. Again, not a kind of nature it had to have, as far as I can see. There's no obvious reason why it should correspond to these extraordinarily beautiful scientific, mathematical, physical equations that we're able to sort of map. And it's almost like it's out there waiting, like this orderliness is out there to be discovered, rather than something we just sort of create and map onto it, onto an otherwise meaningless thing. It's like, for me, it's like the whole thing is screaming, there's something more than this. There's an order, a complexity, a meaning that you're reading off me. And for me, it does make sense then to say it feels like that's the product of something beyond itself.
I mean, it's your book very much goes into detail about the fact that we are special as human beings. We've been designed in God's view. God's,
well, that's I guess, yeah, vision, moving on to the kind of the moral status that humans have.
To me, I have a great difficulty with that, because evolution having taken billions of years, if we started as a single cell creature and eventually we've evolved into the human beings we are today, I have a lot of problems with not believing that the whole of life is interconnected in a number of ways, that we are as much connected to other creatures, other animals, plants, trees, and the rest of it. Because I mean, you look at the DNA samples that have been taken, and they match an awful lot of percentage of our DNA is matched with most other animals, nearly all other animals.
We share
also plants. We share an awful lot. So there's an interconnectedness, which for me, it goes more down the line of evolution being the more likely.
Well, in a sense, I'm not really in the book kind of asking people to choose between, you know, an evolution account of how humans came to be or some kind of special creation. I don't really take a side on that in the book, and because I don't think you have to when it comes to the question of the moral status of humans. I think for me, the chapter you're referring to, which is sort of why I believe God makes sense of human value in a way that atheism, I don't believe, can account for, is whether you think we arose by a long evolutionary process or were special creation or something else altogether. The fact is, we enshrine in laws, you know, the fact that humans are special, you know, whatever the process was that brought us about. We have, you know, the conventions of human rights. We talk and act and treat each other in ways that are different ultimately from the rest of the created order around us. Now, I agree with your point. I think we are interconnected.
Yes.
And I think part of the Christian worldview is to say the reason we've been given a special status, if you like, is part of that is because we are supposed to be looking after.
But do you think we've been given special? This is the point I'm trying to make, is do you think we've been given special status? Well, obviously you do through God. Or is it not just the fact that we are the brightest of the bunch? We have evolved with these brains which are capable of developing science, capable of sending men off to the moon. I mean, that's a fantastic, you know, the achievements of humankind are fantastic.
Yeah, I mean, and that is another way of explaining it, obviously. So it's the naturalistic view is we happen to be the part of the tree of life that has developed these cognitive abilities that give us this unique position.
And there's something in human nature that likes us to be special, isn't there?
Yeah.
There's something in human nature that wants there to be a God.
Mm-hmm.
So that our lives will continue on, because yeah. we know we've got mortality. We're probably the only creatures that do know that one day we're not going to be here, that mm-hmm. we're going to die, mm-hmm. and there's a great fear of death.
Yeah.
And by creating a God, we are, in fact, if you like, hoping for the future that life will continue for us.
Absolutely. And in a sense, I agree, you could make a sort of this kind of naturalistic way of talking about why we're here, why we believe in God. You know, the only thing that I think is that, for me, that firstly, it, you know, to use the technical language, commits the genetic fallacy. That is the idea that I've explained how a belief came about, say the belief in God, because I don't want to die, and therefore I kind of invent yeah. something that lets me live forever. Now, that doesn't actually therefore disprove that thing exists. It might be there are other perfectly good rational reasons for believing in God, and I try to obviously spell some of those out in the book. So yeah. you can. It could be that someone comes to believe in God for non-rational reasons, but there still be a perfectly good other rational reasons for that belief actually being true.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, I would also want to kind of question the just so story of the way we came to be, and that this somehow, that there's this perfect sort of way of sort of, you know, explaining our beliefs by recourse to our evolutionary history. I think My worry, if you like, if I have a worry about the evolutionary sort of stories, is people try to make it do too much very often. And right. that it's actually, it kind of becomes it explains everything, you know, all our beliefs, all our morality, all our purpose. And I don't think you can reduce the human experience to just the things, the biological stuff that makes us want to propagate our DNA. I think most people experience themselves as more than just DNA replicators in that sense, and that's ultimately where all of that must come from, if that's the only explanation for why we believe in love and truth and justice and beauty and morality and everything else. I just find that you know, it takes us into another chapter where I talk about the story of a woman who gave birth to a child, and I've always enjoyed her story. Her name is actually Jennifer Fulweiler. I haven't actually had her on the program before, but I'd like to have her on at some point. In which she grew up very much in that sort of framework of science can explain everything and can explain my emotions and feelings and everything else. But where, when she had her first child, that sort of view kind of got blown out the water because she looked down at her child. And I'll read actually from, in her own words, what she said. She said, "I looked down and thought, what is this baby? And I thought, well, from a pure atheist materialist perspective, he is a randomly evolved collection of chemical reactions. And I realised if that's true, then all the love that I feel for him is nothing more than chemical reactions in our brain. And I looked down at him and I thought, that's not true. It's not the truth." And I think deep down, there's something inside people that most of the time tells them somehow intuitively that my beliefs about human value, goodness, morality, purpose, they're not just what I had to feel because of my evolutionary past. That's something that actually is out there, real, that I can connect with, that makes sense.
I know when I first read that example, the thought that crossed my mind was the emotions, the sheer joy of having a child, seeing the baby's face for the first time. There's no doubt that we must be genetically pre-programmed somehow for that love. And I've had two, three children of my own, and I know that, how that feels. I know the exact feeling of that love that you feel for your own children. That's something that's probably pre-programmed within us.
I'm sure there are...
In order to benefit the child in the future.
Is that for you, Mike, the total explanation of what you feel at that moment?
I think that particular example can be covered with...
You think it could just be explained by the
emotions you feel at the time,
the genetics of that's going on. That,
yeah,
that
I think so. I think
that
particular example. I'm not so sure that I appreciate that was a big, a great story for yourself.
Yeah.
And it obviously meant a lot to you. But as an analogy, I'm not sure that really works for me, because I think there are all sorts of emotions going through a new mother. Probably most intense emotions that you feel for your whole lifetime, I would have thought. So I'm not sure the analogy actually works.
I guess the problem for me then is that what it means is that love is essentially a biochemical reaction.
Yeah.
Now, most people I meet, that just cannot encapsulate the fullness of what love is. because that just does turn it into a biochemical sort of experience that nature has kind of imbibed in us to sort of allow us to propagate our DNA.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that's actually the way most people actually experience it. It's a very reductionistic way of looking at the most meaningful aspect of who we are.
I think the trouble is most people don't want to view it as that, because you don't view anger as something that comes from God. Or perhaps you do.
I think you regard it as part of what it is to be human.
But so is love. I think all the emotions, somehow we're hardwired for these emotions, and it's a survival. It's of a survival purpose. Because, I mean, you've only got to see the fight and flight that's within us all, and who knows how we would react to a situation like, God forbid, that we've had recent weeks up here in London with terrorism and stuff. Nobody knows how they would react.
Sure, of course.
But in that precise moment, you have to make your own decision about which way you're going to go. And I don't think you have time, really, to think about it. I think it's an instinct.
Yeah, I'm not denying that we do. We obviously are biological creatures at some level, which, of course, the stuff that fires off in our brain when we're confronted with a danger, you know, the fight or flight reaction, that's there. It's hardwired. But I don't think that element of who we are constitutes the whole of who we are. I find that way too reductionistic as an explanation of many of the things we think and feel and do. The way, the kind of creativity that we embody, which seems to speak of us looking for something beyond our physical needs. You know, why have we become these self-conscious creatures that...
Well, I was going to talk to you about consciousness, because that's one of the things that I've really picked up recently. Is I watched a really, really good YouTube clip, actually, of Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins talking about consciousness.
Well, shall we leave that for the other side of a quick break? Because we're already at the end of this section of the programme, believe it or not, and this conversation is so fun, but going by too fast, Mike.
It is.
So it's Justin Brierley on the other side of the microphone today, because I'm being interviewed on Unbelievable by former police officer Mike Rand. He's read the new book, Unbelievable, Why After 10 Years of Talking with Atheists, I'm Still a Christian, that is now available, unbelievablebook.co.uk. So I've invited Mike in to ask the questions, to interrogate me. And he's doing a great job of it. Mike, thank you for being on the programme.
Well, thank you
today.
Very much. Just saying,
we're going to have at least another 5 or 10 minutes in the closing part of today's show. I do hope you'll keep listening and listen out for some reactions as well to recent programmes coming up in just a moment's time here on Unbelievable. The world's most published, revolutionary, influential, controversial, burned, used, abused, divined, debated, inspiring and best-selling book isn't being read by Christians. Why not? In the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine, we focus on the Bible and why we need to turn our fast food consumption into a feast. Plus, we speak to Eugene Peterson, the translator of the legendary Message version of Scripture, churches reaching out to prostitutes, why atheists are listening to Christian radio, and much more besides. Ask for your free edition of Premier Christianity magazine at premierchristianity.com/freesample. Welcome back to the final part of this week's Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, the host, bringing you conversations between Christians and non-Christians. This week, though, it's me, the Christian, talking with the agnostic Mike. We'll be finishing our conversation in just a moment's time. We'll be hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's show. Some really exciting episodes, actually, over the last couple of weeks. Far too much feedback, unfortunately, to be able to squeeze it all in. But just some things that I'd like to make you aware of. Just a reminder that with the release of the book, we're doing a special launch event in Woking in Surrey. If you can get along to Woking United Reformed Church on Tuesday the 11th of July at 7:45 in the evening, I'll be speaking there. There'll be some music, there'll be opportunities to get your hands on signed copies of the book, and I look forward to meeting some show listeners there for that event. Details available if you go to the Unbelievable Book website. There's a tab there where you can find out more about that. unbelievablebook.co.uk. Also excited to be speaking at Creation Fest down in Cornwall this summer. I'll be there on the Tuesday the 8th and Wednesday the 9th of August. Tuesday the 8th, I'll be doing a main stage session talking about my book and the show, and then a live version of Unbelievable on Wednesday the 9th of August before the audience there, featuring Andy Bannister as one of the guests, the non-Christian, to be confirmed. But if you're able to get along to Creation Fest, I do recommend it. It's generally a brilliant event with loads of stuff going on. music, kids activities, speakers and so on, all happening in Wadebridge in Cornwall during the early part of August. Just search up Creation Fest on Google and you'll find out more about it there. So some interesting things to come. It's been great as well to be doing some more interviews with various people over the last week or so about the book. The Eric Metaxas Show featured me this last week. If you're able to subscribe to his podcast or get it online, you'll hear what I had to say about the book with him, and some other interesting opportunities coming up to talk about the book as well. So thanks for all those who've been sharing the news and tweeting about it and stuff. It's great to have it out there finally, hitting people's doormats and residing on their coffee tables and so on. And of course, some reviews coming through on Amazon as well. The good, the bad and the ugly for the book. So you can see what you make of those as well. We've got some feedback coming up a little later on in the programme. Don't forget that straight after Unbelievable, there's The Profile. Seth and Nerva, the musical singing duo behind the hit single Brother, are going to be talking to Sam Hales about their life and faith and music. Next week on the programme, there's no Unbelievable show on Premier Christian Radio. We're making way for our regular Giving Appeal Together Now. But if you're a podcast listener, we won't leave you bereft. You will be hearing the audio of a debate between William Lane Craig and atheist philosopher Daniel Kame. That was part of the Ireland tour that Bill Craig was on earlier in the year. And a lot of people wanted to hear the audio of that. So we're going to put that out in full on the podcast next week.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Welcome back to the final part of my discussion today with Mike Rand. Mike is a former police officer, former guest on the show. He's a theistic-leaning agnostic, is the way he would describe himself. And I invited Mike to come on in order to have a conversation with me about my book. I sent it out to him before it was released. He kindly endorsed it as a sort of regular show listener of the programme. And I've invited Mike to come on and interview me about it. And we've had a great conversation. You've been remarking all the way through how quickly the time goes, Mike, which is...
Yes.
I always get that on this programme.
Really, yeah.
Every time we come to a break, they say, was that really? You know, I can't believe how quickly that's gone. Which is a sign of a good conversation, I'm glad to say. So just a reminder that if you want to get hold of the book, you can find it available now, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Wherever you're listening in the world, you can get hold of it. It's available on Amazon or via our own website as well. You can download the first chapter free there as well. A special giveaway today on the show as well. If you want to win one of five signed copies of Unbelievable, the book, you can enter the draw for that by going to the show webpage at premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on the competition link. Leave your details. Tell us why you listen to Unbelievable as well. Do it by Monday, the 17th of July, to be in with a chance of getting hold of a copy of the book. But don't let that stop you from going and obviously getting a copy for yourself as well. Mike, it's been lovely having the chance to sit down and talk with you. I really enjoyed when you came in, you know, over a year ago to have that conversation with David Roberts. And I thought, this is the kind of guy I'd like to just go down the pub with and spend some time with. But we're not in a pub, we're in a studio, but it's been fun. And we are going to do a round two because, as you say, the time has flown. You were just opening up a can of worms, though, before we went to the break. You wanted to talk about consciousness, I think.
Well, human consciousness and self-consciousness, really, because I watched a YouTube clip involving Sam Harris and Richard Dawkins.
Mm.
And they both said the same thing, that self-conscious thoughts and awareness, they've got no idea where it comes from. They discussed it at some length, actually, and they still said that as far as science went, it was still a mystery.
Yeah.
Now, for me, I just wonder if there is a God, the consciousness and self-consciousness that we feel, I wonder if that's some sort of link through to some form of God. I don't know what your views are.
Well, you see, it's an area I kind of purposefully did not open up in the book because it is such a huge one and I wouldn't have been able to do it justice. I mean, I've barely done justice to the ones I have covered, to be honest. But I think it's incredibly interesting. And I think, like all of these things, there's a danger of doing the God of the gaps thing.
Yes. Okay?
And I've been aware of that throughout the book, that whenever we, you know, it's not the right approach to simply find something mysterious in science, in our, you know, understanding and say, well, I'll put God in that gap. But I think there are good gaps and bad gaps, let me put it that way. And there are gaps which kind of open up as we look into something more and where we kind of reach almost a metaphysical boundary where we say, okay, this thing no longer appears to be explicable with our normal scientific naturalistic assumptions yes. about things. And one of those for me would be how kind of time, space and matter came into existence, how anything exists at all. There's sort of a metaphysical boundary there. Another one is the moral universe we inhabit. That's a kind of something where you have to reach beyond the normal tools of science. And I think, and it's an interesting one, where the consciousness is also revealing itself to be one of these boundaries, where we're saying we cannot get from the physical stuff that the brain is made up of to this self-conscious state, which we all experience and take completely as, you know, the norm. You know, we don't even think about it most of the time.
The fact you know you're here.
Yeah.
The fact I know I'm sitting in this studio looking at you.
Exactly. And yet when you actually look into it, it's the most extraordinary, mysterious thing.
Yeah.
And doesn't seem to be readily explainable by, as I say, some kind of reductionistic scientific account. Now, who knows? Maybe we're going to, you know, expand our scientific toolkit. But when we do, I feel like we're going to be opening ourselves up to explanations that won't sit easily with a Sam Harris or a Richard Dawkins.
Well, I think I get the impression it doesn't already. Mm. I think it's one of those scientific quandaries that they're really not sure on. And I find that very interesting.
Yeah, I do as well. I think we're going to definitely explore this subject in a lot more detail, I think, next year on Unbelievable.
Oh,
I'm looking forward to digging into it because I think there's just been some... It's just a hugely interesting area.
Okay. Yeah. I'm mindful of the time. I think perhaps just... quick chat about chapter 3, which was the God makes sense of human value.
Now, yeah.
You had a show last week, a couple of weeks ago by the time this airs, where there was a really, really deep debate, a good debate about mother moral arguments in relation to God.
Frank Turek and Alex O'Connor.
Yeah, yeah. Really, really excellent show. And there's no way I'm going to replicate that.
In the last 5 minutes.
There's no way I could replicate it at all because I thought they were marvellous. But it's something that I really struggled with. I know it's one of your top reasons for believing in God. I know that it makes sense of human value. There's no moral standing without a God. I struggled with it for a while, I must admit. I've really looked at it as morals as being something which is subjective and evolving because they seem to have evolved, certainly from the Bible's point of view. They've evolved over the years. They've changed. Morals have changed. And I was talking to a good friend of mine, Mike, about this the other week, and he put it in a slightly different way from me, because I was talking about the Holocaust, and I said, you know, the Holocaust, the people who carried out the Holocaust committed such awful, awful things that there must have been some knowledge that this was going away from the moral standards of normality. And Mike said to me, yeah, well, they knew it, even though they carried on and did it. So somebody who commits a child abuse, for example, although he still carries out the act because it's an compulsion to do so, deep down still knows that that's morally wrong.
And so I think people get confused, and understandably so, and I don't want to be sort of patronising here either, but that the moral argument is saying we all accept some standards of morality, therefore there must be someone who imposes that morality from on high. And it's not quite that, because, the Bible is full of interesting, confusing, strange forms of morality, especially in the Old Testament, which don't seem to kind of jive with where we are today.
It doesn't fit
and
today.
So you could say, well, it just shows morality is always evolving. It's always subjective. Well, that's not really the argument. It's because I think you have to, you know, we have to be careful about the way we treat Scripture and what it's trying to say to us and everything else. But you can almost put that to one side, because you don't have to believe in the Bible as the moral guidebook or whatever.
Yeah.
You can be of another religion, no religion, and still believe that such a thing as objective moral value still exists. And we only need to identify one thing, if you like, that we think of as something that is non-subjective for that to be enough, I think, to say that this objective moral reality exists, say. And it might be child abuse, okay. You know, For me, the thing is, if you can envisage a situation in which child abuse is ever right or has ever been right, then I can't, basically. I just see that as a non-negotiable, and most people do. And then the question is, if that's the case, it appears that there are some types of behaviour, moral behaviour, which regardless of when you lived and what might have been acceptable, you know, back in the day, we actually know that that's not, that they were mistaken back then. And if we now hold this view, it's because we've discovered the correct one. It already existed, and maybe it took us a while to get there.
So in some respects, it has evolved.
It might have evolved in terms of us coming to the point where we recognised it, but it was still always there. It's not that we make these things up. It's that there are some real objective standards about the way we should and shouldn't treat each other that exist, and we are so often finding our way through the undergrowth towards them. But when we find them and we recognise them, we say, okay, if that is something that really exists and isn't just something I've come up with because of my evolutionary history, then there has to be something that grounds that. And for me, God is the best explanation of that. And for me, that you know, I've tried to express that in this chapter as our common view that humans have this ultimate sense of inherent dignity and value and everything, things that most people agree on, but which it's very hard for me to find a grounding for on a naturalistic worldview.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard a lot of your shows which have covered this, and I really struggled with it for a long time. And I think the only way I can get my head around it is the example I just gave you, that somebody who commits, and I've met people who've committed child abuse over the years, and while at the time they still carry out the acts because there's a strong compulsion to do so, afterwards they're always regretful. So they know deep down that what they've done is wrong, and so they've got to base that against something, that feeling within themselves that what I'm doing now is wrong, or what I've just done is wrong.
But even if they didn't, even if they never came to, you know, admit that what they did was wrong, it wouldn't stop it being wrong. It would just be they'd be wrong. They'd be mistaken about their view about it. Because if you believe it's wrong and always has been wrong, always will be wrong, then there's something objective about the nature of that. It's not just something that's dependent on the culture we happen to have grown up in. If you went to another culture, time and place that had evolved into believing that, you know, child abuse was fine under certain circumstances, say, you might even grow up believing that if you'd been in that culture, it still wouldn't mean that it is fine. It would mean that you'd simply had the wrong perspective on that, because from the perspective you're looking at it now, it for all intents and purposes, it is an objective fact about life. And this is very, for me, it's one which is very intuitive, whereas with the, you know, when we're talking about the fine tuning of the universe, cosmological arguments, we can kind of all point to what, you know, we know about the science behind that and all that. It's something out there that we can point to. The moral argument is something where we look inside ourselves and say, this, I cannot conceive that this is anything but an objective fact about the way life is. It's part of the fabric of reality that this particular thing is wrong, or that particular thing is right, or we shouldn't be racist, we shouldn't treat people like this or that. But if someone else just disagrees with that and says, no, I honestly believe that's just something we make up and everything, that I just have to leave that with them and say, okay, fair enough, I disagree, I cannot conceive how that is something subjective that could have, you know, could be right, could be wrong, depending on your circumstances. So, and for me, all I can say is I perceive it this way, and the only explanation is God. But if someone doesn't, if someone just says no, it has to be subjective. Well, at the very end, I can't see how they would live life as though it was subjective. Most people don't actually live life that way. But
just to clarify a thought for me, then. So generally, everybody would agree it's wrong to kill. But you come to a situation where at time of war, or a time of, like we saw the other day with the horrific terrorism in the UK, I don't think anybody would have said that in the circumstances it was wrong.
No.
There was justifiable homicide.
Of course.
Homicide.
And I'm not saying that there aren't exceptions to, you know, these general laws. But
does the person who's committed that, who's killed that person for genuine reasons and justifiable reasons, where do they then stand?
Well,
morally, are they wrong?
The only difference I would say is that obviously you're then appealing to another moral precept by saying that it was in self-defense, or it was because I had to protect someone else, or whatever it might have been. That doesn't stop there being a objective morality about it. It's just that there was some overriding other object moral issue that kind of came to dominate that one. So I'm not saying I don't believe in the...
But isn't that the problem you're going to have with everything, that somebody could come up with an argument saying, well, I had to commit that offence of rape because otherwise, you cite an example in the book, otherwise my children were going to be killed.
That's where you have to then obviously, you have to obviously then get a bit more specific about what the kind of moral act is that you're talking about. So I wouldn't say killing someone is objectively morally wrong. I would say something like killing someone in cold blood, murdering them for the fun of it, is objectively wrong.
But aren't you then treating it subjectively?
Well, no, because I think you're just being very specific about the kind of intent that's involved in that. Mm. Because obviously, people kill each other and may do so for good reasons, in the sense of, you know,
had to be done.
It had to be done. It was for a greater good. It was, you know, those who believe in euthanasia may believe it's okay to kill people in certain circumstances where, and so on. So there's all those grey areas. I'm not denying there's lots of grey areas in morality. But I think if you can just find single examples where there's really no circumstance under which this becomes acceptable, killing someone for fun in cold blood, for instance, I'd struggle to think of a situation in which suddenly that becomes
acceptable.
There could be so I think you just have to be specific about what you're talking about with these moral facts. And whenever you do find a general principle being counteracted, like in the case of, you know, a police officer shooting someone, it's because there's another important moral principle at stake, which is protecting civilians' lives or whatever it is. And you could equally say, well, that's the objective moral thing that is at stake there. We're out of time. It's been fun.
Wow. Okay. All right.
We have to do a round two.
Definitely. Only on page 4 of the book.
We got a bit further than that, but we today's edition of Unbelievable, very different to normal. Hope you've enjoyed it. It's really a conversation in which Mike interviewed me. Mike Rand has been on the show, former police officer, agnostic show listener, got hold of an early copy of the book and has been kind enough to come in and grill me on it today. And I hope it may have persuaded you to take an interest in what's in the various chapters of the book yourself. You can go and find out more at unbelievablebook.co.uk. Don't forget that competition as well. You can be in with a chance of winning one of 5 signed copies of the book by entering our draw at the webpage, premierchristianradio.com/unbelievable. Click on the competition link, leave your details, tell us why you listen to Unbelievable. Do it by Monday the 17th of July. We'll enter you into that free prize draw. But Mike, are you willing to come back at some point?
Yeah, please. It's been great.
Well, maybe
really
we'll do it in a month or two.
Okay.
But for the moment, thank you very much for interviewing me on the programme today about the book. Again, more details about the book and, of course, the free chapter as well if you want to try before you buy, unbelievablebook.co.uk. Well, thanks for listening. We've got a little bit of your feedback at the end of today's programme, and the ways you can get in touch as well, of course. This is Unbelievable with me, Justin Brierley.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
As ever, if you want to get in touch about anything you've heard today, unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find us online via social media at UnbelievableJB, the Twitter account, facebook.com/UnbelievableJB for Facebook. And of course, leave comments underneath the latest edition of the programme, premierchristianradio.com/UnbelievableJB. Sorry that time is squeezed again. We were having such fun with that conversation. We slightly overran, Mike and I. So apologies that there's not as much time as I'd like for your feedback. We're going to save up some of the feedback to last week's edition of the programme. Fantastic discussion on why are there differences in the Gospels, Mike Licona and Richard Burridge. Lots of feedback to that. Some of it kind of around the issue of inerrancy. Others just saying what a great conversation it was. We'll save that up for a couple of weeks' time and we'll do a big crack at lots of your feedback to that. But still generating a lot of interest, that show between Frank Turek, the Christian apologist, and Alex O'Connor, the young atheist YouTuber. They were talking about whether evil proves God. Tim in Saskatoon, Saskatchewan, Canada, says, just finished this cracking episode with Frank and Alex. Thanks for bringing on such great guests who discuss such relevant topics cordially and rationally. As much as the conversation did point out that both parties were making base assumptions by which their worldview was based, I can't understand understand how the atheistic model is more logically consistent. Assuming logic, reason, and morality comes from a logical, reasoning, moral mind is infinitely more understandable than saying it comes from chaos, entropy, and time. As Alex even admitted, that which is true regardless of how you may feel. And as much as there may be aspects of God one doesn't like, i.e. the fact that he exists and you're made to worship him and not yourself, doesn't negate the fact that these things are still true. Like Frank says, I too don't have enough faith to be an atheist. Yet we're told in Romans 1 how the rebel mind is hostile to God and refuses to acknowledge him. Wonderful Joe, Justin, and all the team working to produce it. Keep up the good work. Thank you, Tim. Paul says, been listening to Unbelievable for a while. I'm a massive fan. Every show provides rich pondering material for the week. I just listened to the most recent podcast. I must say I was far more impressed with Alex than I was with Frank. Alex's demeanour was professional, in my opinion. His argument stronger. There seemed to be a slightly patronising tone on Frank's part. That being said, it was still an incredible, enjoyable show. Both guests argued fantastically. I struggle to believe that Alex was so young, given how wise and well-read he was. On a separate note, I personally am a Mormon, and I'm slightly concerned with the representation Mormonism has received on your show. I listened to one podcast around a year ago about Grace and felt the Mormon side of the discussion was underrepresented. I'm aware of a few other podcasts from around 5 years ago on Mormonism. Doesn't seem that it's ever been done justice. So you're saying you'd like to see some Mormon thinkers such as Terrell Givens, Adam Miller, or Richard Bushman would likely bring a richer presentation of our faith to your show. Thank you very much, Paul, for that suggestion. Joseph in Santa Barbara says, Frank Turek and Alex O'Connor enjoyed their congenial and erudite conversation. Something Alex said baffled me, however. Roughly, he argued as follows. Objective truth means that it's true if it is independent of human intervention. For instance, the Earth orbits the Sun. That's true if every human were to disappear. But if every human disappeared, murder could not still be wrong. This argument is so incredibly strange that I'm surprised Frank said nothing. Existence surely plays some role in truth, but why only consider human existence? The one factor that Alex changed in his argument was the human component, but didn't think to consider the existence of the Sun and Earth of consequence. For instance, if the Earth and Sun disappeared, then you couldn't say that the one orbiting the other is objective, because they no longer exist. If discrediting objective truth is as easy as asserting that something could theoretically stop existing, then nothing is objective, including the Earth orbiting the Sun. This argument is useless, unless, of course, in reasserting Thomistic philosophy that all creation is contingent and came from a necessary cause, which is God. Thanks for consistently bringing in fantastic guests. Look forward to what's coming up in the future. Simon says, great discussion. I commend your guests for their sincere and well-reasoned positions, but any moral construct that either of your guests promote, such ideas will always be logically downstream from one massive glaring background assumption. The assumption is that there is a teleological landscape that underpins any moral construct. You cannot construct nor violate a moral standard until you cross the bridge from purposelessness to purposefulness. But the ascribing of any teleological purposes, like intentionality, is an artifact of intelligent personal agement, not from the inevitable laws of physics and chemistry. As I listened to the conversation, both sides were unavoidably assuming purpose, ends, goals, and teleology embedded in their moral language. I happen to believe, as Frank does, that God purposes the universe as well as humanity. God is the ultimate purposer, if you will. But for non-believers, teleology cannot be objective, and therefore neither can morality be objective. Ironically, the voices that claim to be the most rational are the ones inventing a moral construct on the fly, and then must delude themselves that their moral compass is somehow fixed to true north in a purposeless universe. That's what some people call living a lie. And finally, Ben Schmitterdeal in Rochester, Michigan says, loved hearing N.T. Wright express the joy of personal time in scriptures that he's read, far more times than most of us ever will. His continued discovery in those scriptures of fresh messages and truth might be one of the greatest testimonies there can be of its spiritual origin and the presence of the Spirit himself whenever we open them. I believe anyone who'll give the time to let them speak will find this so. N.T. Wright, that was my brief conversation with N.T. Wright at the end of last week's show. You say you also enjoyed the debate between atheist Alex O'Connor and Frank Turek. He will make a wonderful convert someday. I would, however, suggest we drop the whole argument of who's an atheist and what does that mean. It keeps returning to suck up time, and all it amounts to is labels. We should deal with the actual question at hand. Usually, is there a God or not? Let people call themselves whatever they want. As a case in point, surveys find that a high percentage of atheists pray regularly. Eh? Interesting story about your dad this week, too. Great work, Justin, as always. Thank you very much. Ben. Appreciate you listening. Appreciate all the feedback that comes in every week. Apologies, I can't read all of it out. We'll try and get to a good amount of it when we come back to the normal format of the show in a couple of weeks' time. Lots of feedback, as I say, on Richard Burridge and Mike Lacona's show, Why Are There Differences in the Gospels? But for now, it's time to say goodbye. Hand you over to Sam Hales on The Profile. His guests this week, Seth and Nerva, musicians. Let me tell you, though, what's coming up if you're able to listen via podcast next week on the show.
You're unbelievable.
And I say that because there is no broadcast edition of Unbelievable on Saturday next week. We're making space available for our Together Now fundraising appeal. If you want to give to that yourself, if you appreciate the ministry of Unbelievable, you can do so at premier.org.uk/together now. But if you're a podcast listener or if you go online and you simply can't bear to be left bereft of an interesting intellectual discussion next week, then I'll be putting up the full audio from the Ireland debate between William Lane Craig and atheist philosopher Daniel Kame. I've been told it was a really excellent interaction and I should be putting it out, so I'm going to do so. But for the moment, thanks for listening to this week's programme, and we'll see you again next time.
Shop the Sherwin-Williams Memorial Day Sale and get 30% off paints and stains May 16th through the 26th. With prices starting at $34.29, it's the perfect time to transform your space with color. Whether you're looking to revamp your bedroom, living room, or home office, we have you covered with bold hues, soothing neutrals, and everything in between. Shop the sale online or visit your neighborhood Sherwin-Williams store. Click the banner to learn more. Retail sales only. Some exclusions apply. See store for details.
Why is life better with American Family Insurance? Because every policy comes with something very special. A trusted agent who's there to help protect your dreams by finding the right coverage at the right price. Save up to 23% when you bundle home and auto. American Family Insurance. Get a quote and find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.